Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm here with Steve Kinnane to talk about his new book, Fair Game. Now, it's about Scientology in Australia. And I'm a little concerned for you, Steve. People in the past have taken on Scientology or just told the story of Scientologists and have had some sort of reaction from the community, Scientology community. Have you felt any reaction so far?
Well, yeah, I mean, I take your point. A lot of people said I was crazy to write this book. And Paulette Cooper, who I write briefly about in my book, was a New York journalist in the 1970s, incredibly brave woman, wrote about Scientology then, when I think it was truly dangerous to write about Scientology. I think that's shifted a little bit. They tried to frame her for a bomb hoax. She was facing jail, a jail sentence. And the story was that she thinks that they turned up with a petition to her apartment and they put a piece of stationery under the clipboard. So she would have held that clipboard. They would have got her fingerprints on that piece of stationery. They typed out a bomb hoax and sent it off. And then they were able to try and frame her for that. So certainly in the past, people have been targeted. In 1991, Richard Behar wrote a very well-known expose on Time magazine. He was sued for over $400 million. That court case dragged out for 10 years. He won, the Scientologists didn't win. I think things have changed a little bit since then. I think the internet has changed things. They are less able to control information. And certainly they don't tend to sue journalists as much as they used to. And I think that's partly because they're very scared that their leader, David Miscavige, will somehow have to end up in court and start talking.
So just on a little bit of background, now Scientology was created by or discovered or how do you by Ron L. Hubbard. Is he a founder, prophet? What is he?
He's certainly the founder. I mean, Scientology evolved out of what was Dianetics. Hubbard wrote the book Dianetics in the early 1950s. It was a New York Times bestseller. Became a bit of a sensation. We're talking about post-war USA when the country was in need of a bit of therapy, and Hubbard provided his own form of that called Dianetics Counseling. And during the success of Dianetics, some Dianetics foundations were set up where people would go along and do Dianetic Counseling, and Hubbard was making money out of these. But in the end, the Dianetics foundations went bankrupt. He lost the use of the name. And so he had to reinvent it, and he reinvented it as Scientology. And then he started calling it a church soon after as well. And if you look back at even a letter he wrote to one of the executives he had in one of the Dianetics foundations, he's talking about let's maybe pursue the religion angle. And I found a really interesting document that came from the 1970s where he talked about Scientology and the religion mock-up. So, yes, he is the founder of it, and he certainly used religion as a way of minimising the tax that he had to pay. I mean, the High Court in Australia has declared Scientology a religion. It did that in 1983. All religions are man-made, in a sense, and Scientology is no different. So, he certainly is the founder, but he's also the source, and that means everything he says cannot be challenged by the followers. So if Hubbard, for example, says this is the way you handle critics, Scientology will do that forever.
But he lived a long life before becoming the founder of Scientology. There must be writings of his which make no sense to the religion.
You're talking about his science fiction writing? You're talking about his...
Anything. I mean, he's got letters before then, before he even dreamt up the whole thing. There should be comments. I mean, do they go that far back, or is it everything from the foundation onwards?
Yeah, okay. So, for example, here's a classic example. Scientologists are meant to believe in eternal life and reincarnation, and that you can keep coming back. And that's why when people join the Sea Org, they sign a billion-year contract, because it's assumed they will keep coming back. But if you look at a letter that Hubbard wrote to his wife in the 1930s, it's referred to as a skipper letter. He doesn't believe in reincarnation at all. He talks about how you only get one shot at life and how he wants to smash his name into history. So, yeah, he as a writer, he wrote a lot of things down. And as a journalist and a researcher, you want to thank him because there's so much material out there that you can research Hubbard on and you can see what he said, what he believed. So, for example, the other day, somebody said to me on Twitter, the policy of fair game, which was designed by Hubbard, which basically said you could do anything you like to critics of Scientology. You could lie to them, destroy them, you know, sue them. They said, well, that was cancelled. Well, you can access the policy where he so-called cancelled it. He didn't cancel it at all. What he said was that fair game was bad for public relations and it shouldn't be referred to in public. So you can go back to these documents.
And is that why I've chosen that as the title?
Yeah, that's where Australia, it comes from.
Fair game is almost like fair go.
Yeah. Well, fair game, the term means, you know, somebody has it coming, virtually. Right. You know, that they deserve what they're getting.
So the journalists that got framed and the...
Yeah, so that was Hubbard's policy, that if you criticise us, we'll come after you. And that any Scientologist should not be punished for going after critics of Scientology. That was his attitude. You know, he said that, you know, people attack Scientology, I never forget. I believe in evening the score. He was somebody who believed in revenge, and certainly the people who criticised Scientology and Dianetics early on in the piece in the 1950s were the medical establishment, the Catholic Church, and journalists and scientists. And he would go after them, and he would urge putting private investigators onto them and the like. So, yeah.
Did they get a lot of money very quickly after the formation of Scientology? Did Hubbard actually get to live the life that some of the leaders are living now?
A bit different. Certainly, if you look back in the 1950s, he had money. He was splashing it around. His second wife said that she remembered him buying an expensive car in cash. You know, that all this money was coming into the Dianetics foundations. He did make a lot of money, and that investigation in Time magazine in 1991 I told you about before, that actually stemmed because a journalist who was working at Forbes magazine at the time, Richard Behar, worked out that Hubbard was one of the 500 richest Americans, and that piqued his interest.
Right.
So Hubbard did make a lot of money, but at the same time, he didn't really live an extravagant lifestyle. He was stuck on board that ship cruising around the Mediterranean, which was pretty Spartan. He was in that for the 70s. He was in hiding for a fair bit of his life as well in the late 70s, early 1980s, and he was living in a trailer. So David Miscavige these days, he lives in a lot of comfort. We've seen photos of his office, of, the extravagance surrounding him, you know. So, I would say Miscavige lives the life more accustomed to a wealthy man than Hubbard did back in the day.
Now, in the book, you talk about a centre within Sydney,
yeah,
which could be described as a detainment centre or...
I've referred to it as a punishment camp.
A punishment camp. Now, this is sort of, the suggestion is this is not a very legal sort of place. There are things that are illegal going on in the place. I'm wondering if Scientologists in Australia that today could be excused for confusing the matter, considering that our government, is quite happy to have detainment centres in different places, and maybe they just thought it was part of Australian culture to detain people, and it's sort of our second industry.
Right. Yeah. So you're referring to offshore detention centres and asylum seekers.
People visit jails here as tourist sites. So I'm just thinking if they just got confused and thought that Australia was one of those places where you could do that.
Okay. Well, for starters, these punishment camps, the Rehabilitation Project Force, the particular one in Dundas, started before Australia started becoming engaged in offshore detention centres. But
is that government learning from the public then?
Oh, I couldn't possibly comment. I don't know where they got their inspiration from. But there's a history of that going on in Western Sydney. And, you know, I make the case that they basically treated Australia like a modern day penal colony and sent people, they wanted to be sent as far away as possible to Sydney to be punished. Among them is the first person in my book, Jose, who was sent to Sydney and has now been granted a protection visa on the basis that he is a victim of human trafficking. He was sent here because he was on the Scientology cruise ship, the Free Winds, working as a chef, and he fell in love with the wrong woman. He fell in love with a woman who was being punished, and he was told he was not allowed to have a relationship with her. They persisted, they got caught, he got kicked off the ship and sent to Australia as punishment.
I found it amazing that the government could actually recognise that this was going on for this guy,
yeah,
and allow him to stay, but then not close down the site. like where he was actually detained? It doesn't make any sense.
It's a really good question. Why do we think it's okay for an organisation to be given tax deductible status when we see victims of that organisation granted visas on the basis they're victims of human trafficking? I think there's a problem with going with prosecutions for human trafficking because you could make the argument that this person was an adult and they consented to it. But then there's a question around any organisation that you could describe as a cult, around mind control and around informed consent. How much consent was there when Jose agreed to be sent to Australia? Did he think he could agree? Did he think that he had any say in the matter? I mean, he says when he was here that they held his passport. He feared, when he ended up, when he escaped from the rehabilitation project, he ended up living in the Botanic Gardens in Sydney, eating grass for 7 days. Now, he felt like he had no other choice. He was out here on a religious worker visa, and he thought if police found him scrounging through rubbish bins, then they would arrest him and deport him. And he thought he would then end up with the Scientologists again. They'd send him back to the Scientologists. So, yeah, how much control did he have over the decisions he made? It's a very interesting question. I think that's though why it's hard to prosecute in this area, because they make the argument, well, they signed a form saying they agreed to hand their life over.
I mean, if you didn't take a job in a cafe as a waiter and you signed a form saying I'd just have cash in hand, the government would have a say about that. They would come in and say, well, you can't actually agree to that. You still have to pay tax.
That's right. They would say that person has been exploited.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a good question. Yeah, why have they decided not to go after them? I don't know the answer to that. I know the federal police were looking into it. But for whatever reason, they decided not to prosecute the Church of Scientology.
Now, he's named it. I mean, Hubbard's named it a church. Others mention it as a cult. What is the difference between a cult and a church? Is there a difference?
I think you can be both a cult and a church. I think you can be both a cult and a religion. Some people make the argument it's not a church because church really refers to the Christian tradition, and it's certainly not a Christian religion. The High Court made the decision in 1983 in Australia that it is a religion. But, its behaviour is very unlike any other religion that I know of. What other religion hires private investigators to spy on critics? What other religion has its own internal surveillance system where people fill out forms, knowledge reports they call them, about other Scientologists? It's virtually like the way the East German Stasi operated, a culture of surveillance and snitching. What other religious organisation says that when you leave, you cannot see your family members again? I mean, I know that happens with the Exclusive Brethren, for example, and I think it's fair enough to classify them as a cult. I mean, cults often have a charismatic leader, like an L. Ron Hubbard. Cults engage in forms of mind control and controlling their adherents. I think that applies perfectly to Scientology. So I don't mind calling it both a religion, because people believe in it and they call it a religion, and it's kind of up to the adherents, really, in a sense of whether they believe in it or not. But I also don't have a problem with calling it a cult, because it engages in those forms of control that I've just described.
So what is there? Was it a tactic that's written down somewhere by Hubbard to target people like Tom Cruise and John Travolta and these well-known people to be figureheads?
Yeah, at one point he wrote something down called Project Celebrity, where he wanted to target, at the time, some of the celebrities that he named were Liberace, the journalist Edward R. Murrow, who would be the least likely person to fall for Scientology, I would have thought, a fine correspondent and a man with an excellent bullshit detector. I think Bob Hope might have been one of the people who was on that original list. So certainly he had an idea that targeting celebrities could be a good idea, because he was great at marketing, and he acknowledged the power that celebrities had in a marketing sense. Yeah, exactly. So this is, he's thinking like this in the 1950s. But it took an Australian woman, Yvonne Gillam, who came up with the idea of the Celebrity Centre, and she set that up in Los Angeles in the late 1960s. And she was less interested in marketing. She was more interested in helping these artists, because she was living around the LA region at the time. She wanted to give them a kind of a leg up. She wanted to help them out with their careers. And actors, I think, are the perfect targets for Scientology, because they work in an industry where there's not much employment. They're always looking for an edge to get that job. Mm-hmm. And also they tend to be quite emotionally vulnerable types who love praise and, you know, they love to be told how good they are. And Yvonne Gillam was very good at doing that and making these people feel better. And she certainly had an influence with John Travolta very on in, early on in his career. And he felt that Scientology helped them. He landed his breakthrough role in Welcome Back, Kotter, the TV series that then launched his film career. And he got that role just after he started getting involved in Scientology. So he really felt like it helped him.
And as us as consumers of movies and TV, are we? And if I go to a latest Tom Cruise release, am I in some way helping the Church of Scientology? Is it trickle down from his earnings from that movie? Or?
Well, I don't think you're directly funding the Church of Scientology. I don't think there's a link. You're supporting a film that he's a part of. I don't think that's helping to promote Scientology. Are you asking me whether you, I don't know, it's like...
Because I've had this thought before and I've gone, you know, I've watched a Mission Impossible movie and just gone, now I feel guilty.
Are you directly funding the Church of Scientology? Not that I'm aware of. I don't think they use Tom Cruise for his money, to be honest. I think they use him for his marketing. Though, you could argue that he's become counterproductive to their marketing because in recent years, when he starts talking about antidepressants, when he starts talking about medication for ADHD, he doesn't come across as a rational person. Mm. So you could argue at the moment he's counterproductive. And since the South Park episode, he's been a kind of a figure of ridicule in relation to Scientology. So yeah, don't know if he's helping him anymore.
So you don't really have a go at the belief system within Scientology in this book? Because you say that everyone has a right to their own beliefs. So what is it? What has spurred you on to write this? Is it because you're worried for people who are involved?
Look, I just think they... you're right. I don't go after their beliefs, but I go after their behaviour. And to me, there's a catalogue of abusive behaviour. There's evidence of human trafficking, forced abortions, families being torn apart, cover-ups, all kinds of different behaviour, people being put under surveillance, journalists being intimidated, critics being intimidated, people having their businesses infiltrated by spies. There are so many levels to their behaviour that people would consider to be completely over the top and obnoxious and and immoral. So I think that their behaviour deserves scrutiny. I also think there was a great untold story about how Scientology history collided with Australia, the Australian personalities who were involved, and how Australia influenced Scientology history. So I also had a motivation that I thought this story was very interesting, that there were elements of the story that had never been told. And one of the things I'm really proud about in the book is being able to have, for the first time, the stories of Terry Gamboa and Janice Grady, two sisters who are Australian, who were two of Hubbard's first personal messages on board the Sea Org ship, the Apollo, and then rose to high positions within the Scientology executive. For the first time, they've spoken out. So there's a whole lot of motivations of why I thought this story was worth talking about. But, any journalist is interested in exposing abuse or exposing corruption or malpractice or whatever. And I thought that it was an organisation that was highly secretive, that was not transparent, that committed acts that were abusive, and that it was time to shine a light on those.
Steve Kinnane, thank you very much for coming in and talking about the book. I'm sure that there are so many people in Australia who are very interested to see behind the closed doors of Scientology, and you've put a lot of effort into this book, and at a great risk, I would think. You sort of blow it off, but I think you're quite a brave person for taking this on. Thank you very much for joining us at Booktopia.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Steve Kinnane's book, Fair Game, is available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.